See Sport Pods.
If I could have ripped the contract up, I would have.
We just basically got in too many prima donnas.
The atmosphere at times was toxic.
Hi there, welcome to the Premier League Storybook with me, Jake Humphrey. And we now turn our attention to the bottom of the division. Welcome to the Great Escapes. Naturally, throughout our Premier League Storybook, we've focused on the teams at the top, the title battles that have shaped our view of English football through the ages. But any fan who's ever experienced their team in the midst of a relegation battle will tell you that it's just as, if not more nervy, than a title chase. And look, I'm a Norwich City fan. I've seen my fair share of relegation scraps over the years. And the elation when your team stays up by the skin of its teeth is almost unmatched. And haven't we seen some great moments down the years? Everton in the 90s, more recently under Frank Lampard. Then there was that pitch invasion at West Brom in 2005, which was a bad day for Norwich. No escape, however, has been quite like West Ham's in 2007. Steeped in controversy around the signing of Carlos Tevez and Javier Mascherano, they were cut adrift at the bottom of the league before winning 7 of their last 10 games. We'll hear from Anton Ferdinand about that crazy season. First, though, the Premier League's also had a checkered history of teams who just weren't up to it. Derby County in 2008 were the worst ever offenders, relegated in March with one win and ending on a dismal 11 points. Robbie Savage was signed halfway through that season and was shocked at what he found.
Well, the Derby situation was probably the worst experience of my footballing career, to go to a team in the January. You know, I broke my leg at Blackburn, was never quite the same. And I have sympathy for Paul Dew, who bought me, who put faith in me, made me captain on the first day, which a team had 7 points in the Premier League. Their only win was against Newcastle, Kenny Miller with a goal. And at the first day of training, when I walked in there, you know, in the keep ball session, I thought, what have I done? And if I could have ripped the contract up and gone back to Blackburn on that minute, I would have. But obviously that couldn't happen. My confidence was low. I was never the same player in terms of my energy running around, which Paul Dew bought me for, which he thought I could affect games of football. And the first minute I stepped on that training pitch and seen the quality, I knew I'd made the wrong decision. And it was 2.5 year deal. No relegation clause for me in terms of wages. And, you know, it was a time in my career where I actually started thinking about, I've got to look after me and my family financially. So there was no way I was ever going to go anywhere, because I knew that I wouldn't have got anywhere near the sort of money I would have got if I'd have dropped down. And I had sympathy with Paul Dew. We got 4 points from those remaining games, the worst ever Premier League side. I ended up, you know, in a bad place, really, because I thought my career had finished early. It weren't good enough. And they chased the dream of staying up. And then, obviously, they got themselves into a situation where they're players like myself on big wages who wouldn't leave. And I didn't want to leave because I thought, just stick it out, stick it out. I was training with the youth team. It was a situation where I've learned now as a director of football that, you know, in the professional game, that if a club don't want you, they can do everything they can not to want you, and they can make your life a misery. And that was happening to me. But I was tough, I was strong, mentally strong, and I got through it. On the pitch, the talent, we just weren't good enough. Simple, you knew it. As I said, I knew in the first minute I stepped foot onto the training pitch, and in the keep ball session thought, wow, what a mistake.
Joleon Lescott was delighted to sign for his boyhood club Aston Villa in 2015, but it quickly turned sour when the Midlanders were relegated in awful circumstances.
The whole thing, like, I take responsibility, the club, the rest of the team do. Like you said, we had 4 managers, which obviously never is a good thing. We had a sporting director, a chief exec, a head of recruitment. Tim Sherwood was doing his first pre-season. He'd joined the back end of last season and was doing his first start of the season. And the three positions I just mentioned were doing their job for the first time. We signed, I think there were 7 players that hadn't played in a Premier League. And for me, it was just like, now looking back, I'm thinking there's too many firsts in that. So if it does go bad, whose experience do we lean on? Because there's no one to talk to kind of understand what you're going through, because it's the first for them as well. So it was kind of like, it's hindsight, and obviously it's a wonderful thing when you can look back and see that. But at the time, you're thinking, you're just not considering them factors. You're just assuming, well, you can do your job in isolation, but can you do it when his job conflicts with yours and you're doing it for the first time, and then his role is doing his for the first time? You're like, oh, I just don't believe you can make a transition where 7 or 8 components are new. But up until that point, my family had come to pretty much every game, come to watch every club I'd been a part of, and the fans were making it difficult for my family to come. They were making it personal to them, and that is something I can't get over. Like, I'm sure individuals couldn't get over it if it was them. So when it's like targeted at fans like me, I can deal with it. Like, I'm aware you get criticised. Okay, whether that be personal, that's okay to a certain extent. But when it's family, I was like, if my wife and my kids and my mum can't come to the games because they're getting certain levels of it, I'm like, nah, this is more than this. So that was the hard thing to take. As I said, being part of the relegation was horrible, being a Villa fan. But in regards to making amends to that, I don't think it has. I still receive the same comments now. And I'm over it, kind of thing, to be honest.
So we've heard when it goes wrong, but what about staying up and finally turning the corner when it counts? West Ham have suffered a few heartaches over the last 30-odd years, but it might all be worth it for that one crazy season in 2007 when they signed 2 Argentine World Cup stars out of the blue, changed ownership halfway through the season, and then stayed up after an incredible final few games. Anton Ferdinand was at Upton Park watching it all firsthand. Here's his take. Let's roll the clock to West Ham. And I want to talk about, you know, that what was actually a decent season in 2006. You playing really well. You won Premier League Player of the Month at one point. It was the first season back in the top flight, finished in 9th. So talk us through the mood at the club that summer under Alan Pardew.
Okay, well, I just remember after the playoff final, I just kept walking around. Like, because obviously my dream, every kid's dream is to play in the Premier League. Every English kid's dream is to play in the Premier League, you know, and I'd fulfilled a dream of becoming a professional footballer and establishing myself in West Ham first team, but I didn't actually feel like a West Ham player until I had achieved something. So when we got promoted into the Premier League, I just remember I kept walking around shouting, "Premier League, what? I'm Premier League." Like, I was so buzzing with the fact that I was fulfilling a dream and of mine to play in the Premier League and obviously get to play against Rio. It was finally going to happen, and I just couldn't wait all summer to get back into training. I couldn't wait for the fixtures to come out to know when that game against Man United was, and to start playing against all the top strikers in the league. I was so excited, and the summer was unbelievable for me, and really just that confidence from the last 13 games of the season, that season that we went unbeaten straight all the way into the final, that confidence just overlapped and went into the next season. And I was a bit like a little kid at the time in terms of not my mentality, but around the Premier League. You know, the first time I saw, obviously, I'd seen Ferdinand 5 in Premier League, in the Premier League numbers and stuff, and I'd seen it, but I'd never actually seen one that I was going to wear that was mine, you know, that I was going to start and play in. I'd seen it previously, but I was only ever on the bench. But now I'm a star. I'm an ever-present stay, and I felt like a Premier League player. And when I saw it, I was like, and then when I looked at the badges, the Premier League badge on the side, I was like, wow, like, this is unbelievable. Like, this is actually mine. And I'm actually going to play. And by the way, I can't wait for Match of the Day. This is going to be unbelievable. But what can't happen is people see me getting ragdolled and getting people doing a step over and beating me, because that can't be on Match of the Day, because I was thinking of the backlash from my mates from Peckham, and I didn't want to hear it. So But the Premier League, that's what the Premier League done to you. Put you on a pedestal and put you at a level where you was open to be scrutinised. And being scrutinised by fellow players and that never really bothered me. It was more my mates. I was more worried about the banter from my mates, you know, because I've said many, many a time, the reason why I feel lucky that I played in the Premier League because I wasn't the best of my mates, but I was the one who made it. So when I played in the Premier League and played throughout my career, I always felt like I was representing them too, you know. So I always wanted to make sure that I'd done, as well as my family, my mates proud, because I knew I was representing my mates that I grew up with who wanted to touch the Premier League like I did. And that's what the Premier League done to you. It put you in a position where people were able to scrutinise you and scrutinise you properly.
Nice. Well, you did do yourself proud. You got promoted. You had a really good first season back. And then it looked like West Ham were doing something really exciting. Talk to me about when you first heard about two big Argentinian stars joining West Ham the summer after your promotion. When was the first time that you heard, like, we're going to do something exciting here in the transfer window?
I didn't hear about it until like around, there was whispers happening like I think a week before it happened, but no one ever really thought, oh, okay, yeah, they're going to come, because you're looking at Tevez and Mascherano and you're thinking about the clubs that they actually end up at.
Yeah.
You're not thinking about West Ham.
Well, they were being linked, weren't they, with Chelsea, Man United, Real Madrid were being linked with them at the time.
Exactly. So, like, you never think West Ham, you never think they're going to come to West Ham. And then when you're seeing Javier and Carlos with West Ham shirts in them, and Alan Pardew's in the middle of them, and it's like, wow, this is crazy. But for me personally, I just couldn't wait to show them how good of a footballer I was. You know, I wanted them to respect me as a footballer, you know, and training around that time went up 2-3 notches, I think, because everyone had the same mindset that they wanted to show Carlos and Javier how good each individual was, and training definitely went up. But I must say, for what you see in terms of Carlos Tevez on the pitch in training, it's literally chalk and cheese. You know, he's not a trainer. That's a fact. He's someone who, the only time he came alive in training was in a shooting practice or like a 7v7 game, like a small side of games. Other than that, keep balls, he just tried to nutmeg you and would giggle, you know, and anything else, he was like quite lackadaisical and chilled about it. But then come a Saturday, he was the best player, most hardworking player, and the best player on the pitch. And he's the only person that I've seen, only player that I've seen at that level who is able to switch turn the switch on and off, so can be half-hearted in training, but then be wholehearted in the game, and he actually be the best player. You speak to a lot of high-end athletes and people that have played at the top. Everyone says the same: to be the best possible version of yourself on a Saturday, you have to be the best possible version of yourself all week. Carlos was the complete opposite. As I said, the only time he come alive was in a shooting drill or a 7v7 small-sided game, you know, and that was mind-blowing for me. But the biggest thing for me with that was I wanted to show them how good of a player I was, you know, and I wanted, because obviously I always had that pressure of being Rio's brother. So I knew that I was coming and expecting to see Rio. It's a fact, everyone done that, and that's the way it was with me as a footballer. But I just wanted to show them in my own right that, yeah, I can play. Maybe I might not be as good as Rio, but I'm here for a reason. I'm here because of me and nobody else.
And I guess expectations were high. They certainly were from fans. I remember as a neutral, you know, as a non-West Ham supporter thinking, okay, let's see what they can do now. This could be a great season for West Ham. And quite quickly, things felt like they were sort of unravelling a bit. Can you give us an insight into what the atmosphere was like then in the dressing room? Because you've had these big arrivals. It's always a club with big expectation, and you know, 7 or 8 games into the season, you're at totally the wrong end of the table already.
Yeah, it was. It was, our pre-season didn't help. I'll tell you that much before they came, because obviously this is the following season after our first year in the Premier League. So they came the second season in the Premier League. They came, So the pre-season didn't help at all. We went from the FA Cup final to then going into a pre-season where we was at, in Sweden in the middle of a beer festival, you know. So it didn't feel like a pre-season. We didn't really work hard within the pre-season. Training wasn't of a level that you'd expect it to be. So we went into the season not fit. And obviously Carlos and Javier come, and as I've just explained, what it was like. But they were coming into a relegation battle, because we was from then, you say we was in a relegation battle from then. We weren't winning games, we weren't playing well, you know, and it was almost like, here we go again, West Ham are going to be like a yo-yo club, they're going to go down again. And the atmosphere at times was toxic in terms of, it was good in terms of banter, but in terms of on the pitch, everybody was on separate pages. They weren't on the same page at all, you know, and that evidently is the reason why Alan Pardew ended up getting the sack, you know. And then when Alan Kerbsley came in, things didn't get better straight away. They didn't get better at all. And I remember there was a game, and I speak openly about it now, but there was a game against Charlton, and we had lost. We lost the game 4-0, and it was a big game because Alan Pardew had gone to Charlton and Alan Kerbsley had come to West Ham, so they had switched clubs.
Yeah,
and it was a relegation battle at the time, and we ended up losing it 4-0. And I think 3 out of 4 goals were my fault. And we was in the dressing room after the game, and Alan Kerbsley was saying, oh, we've got to do better next week. We've got, and he's saying like Alan Pardew to me, like Alan Pardew by then was like a bit like, oh, we've got to start doing better, guys, rather than actually telling people what they're not doing right and what they're doing wrong, you know. And he kept saying, we've got to do better next week, guys. This is what Kerb was saying. And I just, the fan come out of me and I just lost my head. And I just said, we've got to do better next week. I said, that's what I've heard from you since you come in the door. I said, no disrespect, but I don't want to hear that. I said, oh, like, if people ain't doing their job, let them know they're not doing their job. And he was like, well, you ain't doing your job. And I said, well, let me know then. Tell me. And I went on for about another 10 minutes. And I was just saying to her, like, listen, if you can't take it and offer the gaffer, you shouldn't be in this dressing room, because you can't play for this club and you can't play for them fans. So if you don't want to do that, then I suggest you get out. And obviously my language is more colourful than that. But
and what was the reaction like from him?
I think he just sat there with me, like he was distraught at the time, and that's not something that I wanted to see from a manager. I mean, your manager's meant to be there to lead, and I just thought, you know what, I've had enough of this. And as I said, the fan, it was more the fan in me, because I was a West Ham fan, it was more the fan in me that came out within the dressing room at that time. And I didn't care, obviously, Teddy Sheringham's in the dressing room, there's other people in the dressing room that are more senior to me, but I was just fed up. I was fed up of seeing people, us as a team and the management and staff, accepting mediocrity, and said I just had enough of it. And after that game, I'm not saying it's because of me, but after that game, we started having more meetings just as players without the management staff, because we needed to get on the same page within our squad in terms of the players. You know, and I remember the captain at the time, Lucas Neal, saying, doing a meeting with all the lads in the meeting room, and the staff actually tried to come in, and he said, and the captain said, no, this is just the players. So, like, we'll see you out there in 15 minutes. And he just basically said to the players, listen, we know we're good enough to stay in this league. We know what we need to do. If we work harder and fight harder than the team we're playing against, we've got enough quality in this room to actually start winning games. But what we're not doing is we're not running. We're not running. We're not working hard. That's what we're not doing. And at this club, this is what we have to do. And he said, is everyone clear in what I'm saying? Because if you're not and you're not on the same page as me, then I'll tell the manager that you're no longer, the squad no longer want you a part of the squad, and you can train with the reserves. Everyone agreed, and after that, we started to win games, you know, and our season turned around, and I remember going into the last home game, we were playing Bolton at home when Anelka was there. And obviously Anelka's a top, top player. And for me, probably the Chelsea Anelka's the hardest player I've ever played against. But I would always not feared playing against Anelka, but I always knew that Anelka was going to be a tough game because I'd watched and seen him play against Rio. And at times give Rio a tough time. And I was like, okay, we're playing against Anelka. I'm playing against Anelka. I have to do my job to win this game.
Yeah.
You know, and we won the game on that day. And I remember doing our lap of honour after the game because it was the last home game of the season. And I felt embarrassed doing it. And I just remember, like, I don't know, it just felt like the embarrassment of walking around knowing that I had put the fans through this all year. But also, we've got a chance to go and stay up, you know, and we're going to Old Trafford next week and we've got to win that game to stay up. So we'd kept our dreams alive, you know, but the embarrassment as a fan and as a player to walk around that pitch that time was something that still today I know the feeling, you know, it's there with me. And then fast forward a week, we went to Old Trafford and to be fair, luckily, United had already won the league. You know, so they'd rested a few players. I think Rio, Giggsy, Ronaldo, they were all on the bench. I think Wayne Rooney was on the bench as well. And I think I played up against Oliver Gunnar Solskjaer and Alan Smith on the day. But we went there to win. I went there and I've always been a firm believer that you go into any pitch, no matter who you're playing, with that mentality of you're going to win today and you're going to be the best player on the pitch, you know, and you're the best player on the pitch. I've always had that type of mentality. And, you know, when we went there and Carl Tevez came up with a goal and we were defending for our lives at times. And I remember clearing one off of the line in the second half, late in the second half, and then to hear that whistle finally go, you know, and we had done it. We had done the impossible because we was in the bottom three around Christmas. And normally teams that are in the bottom three around Christmas don't normally get out of it.
Yeah.
I think that's the stat, isn't it? That people and clubs in the bottom three don't normally get out of it. And we had done it. And again, the West Ham fan come out at me on the day.
And what do you put that turnaround down to in that sort of last bunch of games? You won seven out of the final nine. So obviously this is now a bit of a time after the outburst with Alan Kerbishley. The players have sort of, very interesting by the way, the players have got together and sort of made sure that they're doing their part of the bargain. But it still took a while for results to turn around. What do you put your fingers on for that last sort of seven out of nine games? Because the pressure at that time was massive still.
Togetherness. The banter in the dressing room went up a level. We started doing more stuff together outside of the pitch. You know, what people don't know is the year before, in our first season in the Premier League, when we finished seventh and got to the FA Cup final, we were out as a team. There was no less than six, seven players out at least two, three times a week, you know, and not always out drinking in that nightclub, but going for food, socialising. We were always out together. You know, there was a big group of us always out. And then around that time when we started to win games and started to change and the camaraderie changed was when we started doing more stuff together. I remember Lucas Neal doing quite a few events for us where we'd done a thing where he'd incorporate the girlfriends and the wives, you know, because obviously, as we know, there's some players who can't get out all the time because of their family commitments. So Lucas Neal gave them players no way out, where they do something where he incorporated the wire so that when it was time for us to go out just as a team, it was almost like we've incorporated you now. So when we go to do something, don't make sure that your husband or your boyfriend ain't the one that's not coming because he's got something to do with his family, because this is important to us. You know, and we started to go out more and lo and behold, fortune started to change on the pitch.
And there are two things away from football that I want to discuss with you as well. I mean, the first one is the ownership situation. It was kind of, I mean, when you look back on it, it was just the maddest season on every level. So Edgar Magnusson suddenly rocks up and there's all this upheaval off the pitch. Give us an insight, because players always go, nah, no, didn't really make any difference to us. Like, what actually goes on in the minds of the players or the conversations at the training ground when at the very top of a football club, you're not really sure who owns the thing?
Yeah, personally, me personally, I just thought he was a loony, if I'm honest. I just thought, like, I appreciate, and it's different for me to other players because I'm a West Ham fan, you know. So the things he was saying were exciting. We're a sleeping giant and all that type of stuff. And he's going to take us to the next level. And then when you see Carlos Tevez and Mascherano through the door, you think, we're onto something here, you know. But then, obviously, then you start to hear things start to filter down that there's problems up there and everything that he said he was, he isn't. And everything that he said he's got, he hasn't, you know. And then for people that say it don't affect you, it does. You know, there's no getting away from it. Like people who are embedded in the football club, definitely. People who have grown up in a football club, it will affect them because your relationship with the football club is different. Like my relationship with West Ham, it wasn't just about me and the players. It was about the cleaners. It was about the cooks. It was about the people that you were with every day but didn't earn the money that everyone else earned within the football club. It was about that for me. So, and they were the ones who would have went first. Players, as players, we're secure in a contract on big money, on good money. The people that are the infrastructure of the football club in the training ground, which the people that matter, they're not, and they're the ones that are going to go first. So it becomes a bit deeper. And for me personally, I think that's why it was important for us to stay in the Premier League that year, because of the people that, like the cleaners, the cooks that were there, because they weren't on bonuses. They weren't on, obviously, big wages, and they weren't on bonuses. And also what Lucas Neal done, which I took to other clubs that I went to, which I was fascinated with. And I've mentioned Lucas Neal a lot because he was vital in us staying up as a captain. It was fantastic. What he'd done, he said to everyone, every time we win or draw a game, we get a bonus. Everyone's got to bring a certain amount of money, whether it's a win, and a certain amount of money, whether it's a draw. And what he's going to do, every member of the squad puts that money in the pot. And at the end of the season or at the end of every month, the people who matter at this football club in the training ground, we're going to give them cash bonuses, but it's going to come from us.
Yeah,
and
love that.
I was intrigued as to like what I wasn't against doing it, but I was intrigued because I was all for it. I was intrigued as to why is he doing it. I just said to Anton, the reason why I'm doing it is because if the kit men who ain't on a bonus are getting a bonus, the people that are helping, the people that are cleaning the boots, the people that are cleaning the dressing rooms that we're in, if they know that they're on to a bonus if we win, do you not think everything's going to be done for us properly? But what that does, that eliminates every excuse that a player will have. So now we've got to look at us. And I was like, yeah, I get it. I really get it. And I end up taking that to every club that I've been in a relegation battle. We've ended up doing that. I've done it at Sunderland. And at Sunderland, it was unbelievable. And I'm not here to talk about that, but it was unbelievable. The cleaner ended up getting an extension on our house off the back of it. When we played West Ham away and we had to win to finish in the top 10 to get a bigger bonus, you know.
Love that. But that's well earned and well deserved.
Exactly, but that's what the pressures of footballers, and I think people and fans alike don't understand that we are human beings. We do have feelings. As much as you might see a cold-blooded person and an egotistical person on the pitch, we do think about, and there is a lot of us that think about, the inner workings of a football club and the people that we work with every day, you know, and we understand and know that they rely on us, you know, and that's a big factor in especially me as a person and the squad at that time was more thinking about the people that were in the engine room.
So look, you've had a change in ownership, you've had a change in management, you're scrapping for your lives in the Premier League. Can anything else throw a spanner in the works? Yes, we then have that whole court case around the Tevez Mascherano situation. So again, as players, like, how do you deal with that? Do you educate yourselves on what's going on? Did you talk about it a lot? Did you speak to the two players themselves to try and get their side of the story? I'm fascinated how that worked, because it's like, it's another thing for footballers to deal with that normally you wouldn't be dealing with.
Yeah, I personally didn't. I just wanted to concentrate on football, you know, and the minute that I would have seen Carlos or Javier in distress about it, then that would have been a time for me to start panicking.
Yeah.
You know, but
their levels, did they stay the same and their approach stayed the same?
No, they got better. Really? Especially Tevez. Tevez got better, you know. And as I say, it was more of I didn't really look at it. I was just like, okay, I'm paid to play football. When it's something that's out of your control, when it's not, like you say, different, when it's your chairman and that's filtering down into the club. But when it's a court case and you're not in control of it, you know, you can't control the uncontrollable. So you just got to do your job, you know. And like I said, that's what it was about. It was about making sure that the team was focused and able to go out on the pitch week in, week out and give this all.
So I imagine at the end of this season, the relief was quite something. I mean, you dealt with so much. You'd stayed up right at the very end. Did you know any of the players that were in the clubs that got relegated?
Yeah, I knew, obviously, I played with Leighton Baines at England, so I knew Leighton. But to be honest with you, he went down with Wigan that day, didn't he? So I'll be honest with you, I weren't thinking about anyone else. I'll be honest with you. I wasn't of the thought process of people that I know have gone down. I was just buzzing that we stayed up. You know, we're athletes. We're paid to do a job. We're paid to play for the club that we play for. And as I said, there was no care about other people on the day, other teams on the day. It was just solely about West Ham and us as a club and as a team.
Yeah. Oh, how was the party afterwards?
It was lively. But that's what I mean. We talk about Carlos Tevez, and you hear a lot of people talk about Carlos Tevez, and people talk about foreign players that come over here and don't get involved in the banter and stuff. Carlos Tevez couldn't speak English. His English was minimal, right? But you see, when we went out, he came and he brought the interpreter with him, you know? So
yeah,
I remember being in embassy, me, Coley, and a few others were in embassy, and he was on a dance floor. I just remember I was at the bar and he was on a dance floor dancing. Carlos Tevez on the dance floor and people were double taking him. Carlos Tevez, it was mad. But he fully got involved in the culture of English football, and he fully got involved in the lads. I always knew if he'd been to the casino. You know, I'd always knew if he'd been to the casino, like, and been there till late, because he'd come in training. But I'd never know because of him. You could never tell on his face that he was tired. I always knew because the interpreter looked like he had matchsticks in his eyes. So when he came in like looking tired, I was like, "Oh, Carlos has been to the casino. He's been in the casino last night." And I would say, "Casino?" And he go, "Me? No, not me. And then I look at the interpreter and he'd just be like that.
Amazing. Have you played in a dressing room since that had that sort of level of scrutiny, level of upheaval, but also the passion? I mean, I've heard Marlon Harewood talk about a big fight that happened before the winning run in the dressing room. I don't know how commonplace that was in other clubs that you'd played in, or whether there was a particular sort of fieriness to this team to keep West Ham in the Premier League.
Yeah, I have. I don't believe you can't stay in. You can't stay. We're talking about arguably the best league in the world. There's no easy games. You have to be able to fight. You have to be able to. But you have to have a togetherness, you know. And for me personally, I think every club that I've been at, or every club that's been in a relegation battle, there has always been a turning point, and it's always started with something happening in the dressing room. It's always been that way.
And how did it come about that day?
I think Marlon's talking about the Charlton game. It's the Charlton. It'll be the Charlton game that Marlon's talking about, where I just lost the plot and said it wasn't nothing physical, but I think, as I said, the fan came out of me and the passion and And I was shouting. You know, it was probably aggressive at the time.
So he's talking about you when you had the outburst against Kerbishley and that, is he?
Yeah. It'll be that he's talking about.
And did you notice an impact from the other players as well? Because a lot, I know you got together and you sort of had a conversation, but in terms of them seeing you take the lead in that way, even though you weren't the captain of the club, to then respond, because there was that brilliant game against Spurs. I know you lost the game 4-3, but it was like a game full of fight, full of desire, full of spirit. Do you think that the way that you reacted that day impacted some of the players long term?
Yeah, massively, massively. And to be fair, I shouldered a lot of the burden that day, because that was the day that it come out in the news of the world that I was in America in a mid-season break when I wasn't meant to be.
Uh-uh.
Yeah, it was the week before we lost to Charlton 4-0. And obviously I said to you, like, 3 out of 4 goals were my fault, and I was dreadful in the day. And it come out, we're playing Tottenham, it's a massive derby, it's at Upton Park. And the manager got wind of it the day before the game, that I'd gone to America and I shouldn't have gone. Because he didn't allow anyone to go outside of Europe.
Yeah.
But I went. And
Listen, Antoine, you were kind of what I would call a cultural architect, right? You led along with other players, you were one of the leaders there. So how did you come to make the decision that it was okay for you to do that?
I was young and stupid. With the previous manager, Alan Pardew, we were allowed to go anywhere. You know, this was our first break with Alan Kerbishley. So because I was used to being allowed to go anywhere we wanted for that weekend, and it was around my 21st birthday. So, and one of my mates lived and went to university in America, in South Carolina. So I was like, he's throwing me a party for my birthday. Like, I'm going. Like, and I'd already booked flights for my mates to go. And then I was leaving the Thursday evening. Remember, there used to be a flight from Stansted to New York.
Yeah.
A direct flight from Stansted to New York of the evening, because there was never evening flights to America. Like, this was the only evening flight. So I went straight from train on the Thursday to get on that flight to New York, and then change and go to South Carolina. But because I had already booked it, and on that Wednesday, the day before I was leaving, there was a sheet of paper just floating around in the dressing room, and it just said, no players allowed to go outside of Europe. It wasn't like it was on the information board. It wasn't on none of the boards, anything. So I was just like, you know what? As I said, young and stupid, and thought, I've paid the money, I'm going, you know, and no one will find out about it. In that party, there was a West Ham fan who went on the blog site. I now know there's a American West Ham fan in that party who went on the fan blog sites and was saying, I've just come from Anton Fernandes' party. It was unbelievable. And somehow the press got hold of it via that, you know. And as I said, I was a leader on the pitch and leader around the dressing room. But I was still, I was 20, 21 at the time, still a kid.
Yeah.
You know, and as we see and know, we see a lot of kids today do silly things. But all we can ask is that they learn from it, you know. And just leading into that game with Tottenham, Alan Kerbishley pulled me in, and what had happened is the press officer had asked me, like, and I'd been away, and I just said, yeah, I went to Isle of Wight to see my nan and granddad, is what I said to the press officer. And then all of a sudden, Alan Kerbishley calls me in and he goes, I've heard you went away, like, at first, is it true? And I went, I'm not going to lie to you, yeah, I went. And I explained to him why I went. And he just went to me, okay, well, we play Tottenham tomorrow, big derby. We're in a relegation, but he said, obviously, I'm going to get asked questions about it. He said to me, if we win the game, I'll say to the press, I'll let you go. If we lose it, it's all on you, is what he said to me. And it didn't really sink in what he said to me at the time. I was like, flipping, more than anything, focused on the game. And then as I went to leave the room, went to leave his office, and I put my hand on the door to come out of the office, he went, oh, and by the way, that'll be 6 weeks' wages. So I got 2 weeks' wages for 3 months.
Oh.
got 6 weeks wages, fine. And then obviously we lost.
You got fined
the game
6 weeks
in the last
wages.
Yeah, for 2 weeks wages, for 3 months.
Right, mate. That is a very, very expensive party.
I know. It was unbelievable, Doc. I must admit, it was one of the best parties I've had. It was unbelievable.
Was it worth the money?
I sit here today and I say yes.
Okay, fine. Life's about experiences. And listen, in the end, West Ham United stayed up, so it didn't cost the team in the end. What an interesting conversation.
I don't think any club could have had a crazier season than West Ham had that year. How amazing as well to get the true inside story from Anton. It made me think actually about players in that situation. Just because they're part of a team that ended up going down, you know, it doesn't mean that they're bad players. Peter Crouch had a great career at the highest level, but suffered relegation with Southampton when he was younger, and then much later on at Stoke. Here's the former striker on what the atmosphere is like at a club such as Stoke when they're at the bottom of the league.
Oh, understandably, you know, not very good at all. There's points where you think, you look at the games and you think, oh, there's a win there, there's a win there, there's a win there. And then you lose those games and you think, well, we've got those three left. And you go, well, we've got those two left. And you just it feels like you keep ticking down and you can't buy a win. And I always remember, certainly when we went down with Stoke, like we'd be 2-0 up at half time and we'd be battering the team. And you think, we'll go and get 3 or 4. And then half time comes, you go out again and the ascendancy changes. It just changes. And they get one and you just go, oh, here we go again. And that it's that mentality of like, we're going to lose this. And you just know you're going to lose it. And you think, and then they get a penalty in the last minute. They score and little things like that just keep going against you. But the reason they go against you is the mentality, I think. And you just can't, and it's so hard to get out of it. And, you know, you need characters and strong people in your team. And quite often the teams that get relegated don't have them. I went from having the best dressing room in probably I've ever been with to one of the worst, you know, and just players not pulling their weight, players not caring. We just basically got in too many prima donnas, and from, you know, like I say, just probably a workmanlike, great attitude, great lads, overachieving ability-wise, to bags of ability and the attitude not being anywhere near it was. And, you know, with those kind of traits, you inevitably get relegated. You know, if players don't care about the place they're playing, then it's going to take its toll and affect the results, and that's exactly what happened.
Thanks for joining us on Premier League Storybook for another week. It was great to give the other end of the table the attention it deserves. Tune in next time when we look at arguably the greatest moment in Premier League history, and I'll give you a clue. It happened in injury time. BT Sport Pods.